You are about to hear Mr. Melvin Douglas introducing leading statesmen of the world, troops of many nations in Korea, Mrs. Roosevelt speaking to distant capitals, a report of a flying mission into Southeast Asia jungles, and many other highlights as United Nations Radio presents Eyewitness 52.
This is Melvin Douglas. Listen to the voice of the most famous clock in the world, Big Ben. Its home is London, near the very center of time, Greenwich Mean Time. Through this central point of time, the world can keep in step with its hours, minutes, seconds. Now from the Thames River, London, switch to East River, 42nd Street, New York. As we stand on the threshold of 1953, we greet you from another world central point, the center of many of our hopes and aspirations for the new year and for the new years to come. This is headquarters of the United Nations. And now down to the studios of United Nations Radio, where a daily running account of UN history in the making goes out to every corner of the world in 21 languages. I've just met a group of UN radio reporters gathered together from among the broadcasting systems of 60 nations that make up the UN. Their job is to report the facts of UN happenings to the world. Eyewitness 52 is their story. I asked first about Korea.
Well, I suppose the first thing that hits your mind is what we're doing in Korea.
That's right, I replied.
Well, for a short and to-the-point answer, I think of the words of Australia's Minister for External Affairs, R.G. Casey.
I think the best and shortest answer was that which Mr. Churchill gave in reply to a similar question during the 1939-45 war, when he said, if we stopped, you'd find out.
UN radio reporter Movshin had been to Korea twice.
The first time I went at 24 hours' notice, watching and reporting the fighters, the negotiators, the soldiers, and above all the ordinary, simple people of Korea who had been thrust so quickly and so painfully into the world spotlight.
There are many dimensions to the Korean picture, but the main one is that for the first time in history, the world community was acting on the principle of collective security, that danger to one was danger to all. This was not just something on paper, but a free world standing together, backed by a United Nations army. As their commanding general, Mark Clark, told reporters the day he left for Korea,
I'm exceedingly proud that I will have under my command so many fighting men of the United Nations, many nationalities.
Today, under the UN flag in Korea, are the Dutch, like Sergeant Snoeisch.
I got wounded, I got hit by a hand grenade, I got two shrapnels in my stomach and one in my leg.
And the British, like Rifleman Yeomans.
But I do really want to pass on to you at home how the individual rifleman, the individual British soldier, did a grand job.
The field surgical and hospital teams of Danes, Italians, Norwegians. From India, medics like V. Rangaswamy.
We were happy indeed to be called up by an American parachute regiment to drop a surgical team behind the enemy lines, and thus came in handy indeed.
UN soldiers like Colour Sergeant Lowry.
Hello, Belfast, Northern Ireland, and people elsewhere. I'm afraid the people of the old town wouldn't recognize the stickies running around here in this jungle green outfit. With, of course, the inevitable teapot stuck underneath their arm. My love and best regards to all at home.
American boys, like artilleryman Strasser.
This battery has supported various troops of the United Nations Army. At different times, we have supported our own American troops, British troops, Bylanders, French, Turks, and Greeks. We will fire on targets for any troops. All they have to do is call back. We give them the fire.
Yes, and the rocks from South Korea, the Canadians, the South Africans, Australians, and New Zealanders. UN troops from Belgium, Colombia, Luxembourg, Ethiopia, and the Philippines. Many of their units have won citations.
General Orders number 16, dated 7 January 1952. The Greek Expeditionary Forces Battalion, United Nations Forces in Korea, is cited for outstanding performance of duty, The extraordinary heroism displayed by the members of this unit reflects great credit on themselves and the military service of the Kingdom of Greece by command of General Van Fleet.
I must report to you that just as 1952 was drawing to a close, the UN radio correspondent who succeeded reporter Mobshin in Korea lost his life.
He was my associate and friend, George Teodoro of the Philippines, war correspondent from 1941 to 45, UN worker in Shanghai, Sydney, New York, Geneva, Korea. Here at UN headquarters, the name of George Teodoro is honored, together with those others who've given their lives for an ideal.
It's perhaps fitting to glance at a private letter written in answer to a query on why do we fight? UN official and Nobel Prize winner Ralph Bunche answered that letter himself and read for us his reply.
I consider these men to be the most significant heroes in human history. Had the United Nations not come to the rescue of the hard-pressed, virtually defenseless peoples of South Korea, it would have failed as fatefully as the League of Nations failed, and the Third World War would be a dead certainty. Korea has had to serve as an object lesson for all future would-be aggressors. If the rights and freedoms of the people of the Republic of Korea cannot be protected against aggression, then you may be sure that the rights and freedoms of all other peoples, including our own, will be in serious jeopardy. If the United Nations succeeds in its determined and far-sighted effort to keep the war in Korea limited and localized, and thereby saves the world from the catastrophe of an all-out atomic war, Michael and his comrades in arms, those whose lives have been given, will have more usefully and more gloriously served the cause of humanity than any fighting men in the entire history of mankind.
And that's about it for my recollections. Except for some music I shall never forget. The children in an orphanage singing Jingle Bells. You may not recognize the words. They're in Korean.
Korea is over 10,000 miles away from UN headquarters. But in reality, it's next door. For the question of whether we're to have war or peace is being faced by world statesmen gathered in the council chambers of the United Nations. Step by step, these delegates have helped smooth out conflicts in Palestine, Indonesia, Iran, Greece, any one of which might have ignited a general war. Have you ever wondered what it's like to follow those meetings day after day? UN radio reporter Berenson, whose job is to observe and report via radio in English and French to listeners in many parts of the world, gave me an insight.
Have you ever seen a watchmaker put a magnifying lens to his eye and peer into your watch? That's pretty much the feeling I get as I observe the ticking off of vital words which lead to historic decisions.
From his glass-enclosed booth overlooking the council halls, our reporter is on the air, giving an eyewitness picture of the debates and conferences of the United Nations. The personalities of Pearson, Austin, Madame Pundit, Vyshinsky, Jeb, Romulo have become as familiar a sight to him as my next-door neighbors are to me.
I try to give a balanced, objective picture to many different nations, to explain the issues of the debate, the background, to maintain a proper perspective. Admiral Nimitz, for example, had a perspective on these meetings.
As long as you can keep them at the conference table talking, there's always a chance that out of it will come a peaceful solution.
There were many memorable moments in 52.
Of course, a major one was an East-West issue, with the Soviet Union's chief delegate, Andrei Vyshinsky, referring to a ceasefire in Korea, as it was proposed in a recent Indian resolution.
Господин председатель, господа делегаты, целый ряд ораторов, выступавших сегодня после обеденного заседания.
The voice of the interpreter.
Therefore, the argument is that we are unwilling to put an end to the war in Korea, and they are willing to put an end to the war in Korea. We are unwilling to put an end to the war, but we call for deeds. They are willing to put an end to the war, but they don't do anything about it. This is laughable. Why wouldn't you be bold for a change? Do adopt our amendment for a cessation of hostilities in Korea. Why'd you take that risk? But you wouldn't dare do that, because Mr. Acheson has said already that there can be no question of a ceasefire until the question of the prisoners of war has been settled.
The reply by United States Secretary of State Dean Acheson, who supported this Indian resolution.
I think that any delegate who had a moment of despair after listening to Mr. Vyshinsky's speech would be fully justified. But I think we must all agree that that moment must pass. For I believe no nation or nations in the world, no matter how powerful, can long stand against the combined moral opinion of the world.
A voice of conciliation, India's V.K. Krishna Menon, urging acceptance of his own resolution.
Settlement in this matter, Mr. Chairman, is a two-way matter. We have no illusions about it. And therefore, Mr. Chairman, with all the earnestness that we can command, we ask you in the name of peace, in the name of bringing this trouble to an end, to pass this resolution from this committee without a dissentient voice.
And the other issues, Palestine, Kashmir, Tunisia, South Africa, to mention some. There are few mornings indeed that we don't find a world problem on the UN's doorstep.
Debate, argument, pro and con, the points of view of many nations, backgrounds, cultures.
These debates are healthful. They ventilate differences of opinion. You see, Mr. Douglas, in the past, these differences might have built up and exploded. I once heard a delegate say, a smoking volcano may prevent an earthquake.
I understood. A sort of world safety valve. It brought back to me the milestones in man's progress, the English Magna Carta, the French Declaration of the Rights of Man, the American Bill of Rights. All born out of argument and compromise. Today, a further step is being taken by the United Nations, and world peace is being built out of negotiation, mediation, conciliation, foundations of a bridge to bring the peoples of the world together.
This is Eleanor Roosevelt. I want to tell you about something that's very close to my heart.
The voice of Eleanor Roosevelt was heard on a worldwide UN broadcast in 1952 on December the 10th. How the corners of the world were linked up for this special program, and more especially why, was the Eyewitness 52 story told me by UN radio reporter Rose.
Well, as you know, December 10th is Human Rights Day, observed all over the world. The Human Rights Declaration says, in effect, that there are certain rights that belong to you as a human being. When the Declaration was adopted in Paris in 1948, not a single nation opposed it. We thought we'd take a radio look about the Earth and see if the Declaration was achieving its purpose. So, we enlisted the aid of one of its principal champions, Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt. And then we set up circuits. First, Mrs. Roosevelt put in a radio call to Washington.
Dr. Charles Malik in Washington, D.C., I know you can hear my voice. You succeeded me as chairman of the Human Rights Commission. What is your answer? Are nations following the declaration?
Mrs. Roosevelt, I think it can already be said that this declaration is an historic document of our time. The declaration has had an acknowledged influence upon the new constitutions of Costa Rica, El Salvador, Haiti, Indonesia, Syria, Libya, Eritrea, and Puerto Rico. It is therefore no exaggeration to say that this humble text, on which you, Mrs. Roosevelt, and I and many others labored for 3 years, has had and will continue to have an incalculable effect upon the destiny of mankind.
Thank you, Dr. Malik.
I was told a call would be put in for the far Pacific. I wondered how this would work out with differences in time.
Well, you have a point there, because, as you know, when it was today at UN headquarters in New York, it was yesterday where London's Big Ben is heard, and it was tomorrow where we're calling next. Across the international dateline, 13 hours time difference. Mrs. Roosevelt was ready for the 14,000-mile circuit, New York to San Francisco, to Hawaii, to Manila, and back.
We have a long way to go, but there have already been some exciting human rights experiments. In the Philippines, for example. Come in, Manila.
Here in the Philippines, as early as when children are in elementary school, the meaning of the Human Rights Declaration is explained to them. To make the school children readily understand the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, we ask you to join us on a visit to a typical Philippine classroom at Cusco Lucban Elementary School in Manila and listen to a recitation of the simplified articles.
Article 1. All people are born free and equal, like brothers and sisters of the married family.
Article 1. All people are born free and equal, like brothers and sisters in a large family. Article 2. Your rights have nothing to do with your wealth, family, religion, sex, color, or political belief. Article 3. You have the right to live. Article 4. No one can make you a slave.
And then, back to Mrs. Roosevelt at UN headquarters in New York.
Our story isn't over. In fact, it has just begun. The Declaration of Human Rights is only the first step. Next come the covenants, the documents which make human rights enforceable. And beyond that, there are the hopes and the dreams of 2 billion people in the world.
In 1952, the year of supersonic planes, the drums are still beating in many jungles of the world. The same centuries-old jungles we've all seen portrayed in stories. But what lies in back of these drums is a true account that far outruns any fiction. UN radio reporter Keene was assigned to this story, and he told me how it began.
You know, Mr. Douglas, when you come to work in the morning at the United Nations, you can't be too sure that you might not get some assignment which will take you out of the country by that night. That's practically what happened to me when the UN sent me to Paris to make some radio programs out of some tape-recorded material which had been made by a United Nations reporting team in Southeast Asia. That mission, sponsored by the UN and its specialized agencies, covered 25,000 miles in just an even 100 days by plane, jeep, boat. United Nations technical assistance teams were at work in improving the health and the living standards of the people. There is one story which shows how the jungle is being pushed back. In the jungles of Borneo, in the teak forests of northern Thailand, on the road to Mandalay in Burma, in the waterlogged fields of the Ganges Delta, up to the Tiger Jungle on the borders of India.
For hundreds of years, few, very few, could live for long in the Terai, until only yesterday, the tiger and the elephant put back their ears in fear. Man was coming back with music of a new world. Yes, the song of bulldozers and tree dozers. India had called for international help to attack the Terai jungle so that food could be grown for the hungry millions. We saw tree dozers lean against giant trees and uproot them. The heavy plows turned over the soil for the first time in 1,000 years. The jungle was in retreat.
I asked Keene how these technical assistance programs affect the world at large.
By contributing to international security and peace, through improving the standards of life and social progress for all men.
That's what the UN strives for and stands for. Men of many nations helping each other, removing the causes of war in the jungles of poverty, disease, hunger, and ignorance.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm speaking to you from the center of the great Assembly Hall of the United Nations. This is probably the first broadcast, the first of many broadcasts that will come to you from this central meeting place of the 60 nations, the United Nations.
The date was July 18th, 1952. I asked UN radio reporter Tovell, who covered that event, the natural questions about this meeting hall of the world, the building of which now completes the construction of United Nations headquarters.
Well, sir, I asked those same questions myself of a gentleman who was standing by my side during that broadcast, the director of planning for the new headquarters, Mr. Wallace Harrison. He, along with leading architects from many countries, designed this symbolic addition to New York's skyline. Mr. Harrison, I'd like to ask you if you could sum up for us in just a few words the kind of United Nations center that you had in mind when you designed this assembly hall.
Of course, the essence of any building is the kind of atmosphere that you want to create. The atmosphere becomes almost more important than the practical use to which the space is put, because over the centuries, the practical needs change. We wanted it to have the dignity, the simplicity of a group of nations united for one common purpose.
The architects had given their best. What did the public think of the UN's new home? We might let you hear the reaction of a first-day visitor, one of the third of a million people who have gone through the building just during the 2 months of the 1952 General Assembly. This is how the headquarters looked to another Douglas, Kirk Douglas.
The building itself was quite astounding, I must say. I've never seen a building quite like it. So many things that I wasn't aware of, I began to learn today, and it's one of the reasons for my visit here, and I intend to make quite a few more.
UN headquarters didn't just happen. It had to be built, blueprint by blueprint, stone by stone, like the UN itself. Now, not everyone can visualize what a finished product will look like when you start. In building a permanent headquarters, old tenements and slaughterhouses had to be demolished in order to clear a place for the foundation. So, for this Eyewitness 52 story, we shall have to go back to the autumn of 48. UN radio reporter Sparks took position overlooking the excavations. He wanted to hear what the sidewalk superintendents were saying.
What fascinates you about looking at this?
I'm interested in these guys down here digging the hole.
What is your feeling as a person who belongs to one of the nations of the United Nations? What is your candid feeling about the whole thing?
I think it's pretty wonderful. I think if the United Nations works, it'll be the most wonderful thing that ever happened to us.
I noticed that you qualified your statement. What do you think might make it not work?
Only us, only people.
Then construction began. And on October the 5th, 1949...
The final beam has just been put into place, completing the steelwork for the first building of the UN headquarters. The UN flag is being unfurled by the Secretary General of the UN. I have the honor of presenting Ambassador Warren Austin of the United Nations.
This is another notch in our barrel. We feel that the erection of this great building marks an achievement, not only in building, but in the erection of the institution of the United Nations. We have many obstacles yet before us, but we have the courage and faith to go ahead.
That band is sounding the arrival at the outdoor dedication of the President of the United States. It was the 24th of October, United Nations Day, 1949, the day of the cornerstone ceremony. 500 workmen sat on girders and peered down out of unfinished windows.
An audience of over 10,000 visitors sat on folding chairs. Below, leading statesmen of the world assembled as the president began to speak.
These are the most important buildings in the world, for they are the center of man's hope for peace and a better life. This is the place where the nations of the world will work together to make that hope a reality.
Then 1952, October the 9th, the long-awaited day arrives. The General Assembly Hall and the headquarters are complete. The Secretary General sends an invitation to his staff.
Yes, as members of the United Nations Secretariat, who do the day-by-day work serving the delegations, we were invited to be the first ones to inspect the new General Assembly Hall. We took seats that would soon be occupied by delegates of 60 nations, looked up at the great dome, the unusual architectural designs, and then the Secretary General walked to the new green marble dais and started to speak to us.
Many of you have been with me on a very long journey now. We started in January 46 at Church House, London. Then we came to Hunter College, then to Lake Success. But now, I think we are at the end of our journey at the permanent headquarters of the United Nations.
The Secretary General reviewed various phases of UN activity, introduced the chief headquarters architect, and then summed up the aims of our work.
This organization should be the servant of the member nations to do the best we could do, every one of us, to secure peace and do our best to improve the living conditions all over the world. Keep always in mind that the United Nations Charter, the United Nations itself, that is the target and that's the aim and that's what we live for and what we work for.
That stir of reporters and press photographers was heard at UN headquarters November the 24th, 1952, on the occasion of the first visit by the President-elect of the United States, Dwight D. Eisenhower. With Mr. Trigvie Lee, General Eisenhower paused in the Security Council chamber, obligingly posed for photographers of the world's press, and then commented upon what he had just witnessed.
Because this building, the people in it, and their work are, in sum, the symbol of the free world's hopes for a peaceful and secure future. It is an inspiring experience to come here. I think every true citizen of the free world will follow and does follow the activities that go on here with the keenest and most intense interest.
The people at the UN, your representatives, all of us, join you as we hopefully face 1953, like these youngsters, singing jingle bells in Korean.
You have just heard Mr. Melvin Douglas narrating Eyewitness 52, an account by UN radio reporters of United Nations news events in the year just past. Eyewitness 52 was prepared for radio and directed by Jeff Sparks. The program was produced by the international staff of United Nations Radio.